What's up, OUXers? Today we have a double interview, a discussion with an amazing UX designer duo, Andrea Newhoff and Kristen Kite. We'll be talking about their work together at Duo Security, which is a Cisco company that provides organizations with authentication and security products. And we'll talk about how they have started bringing OUX to Duo for a double whammy of complexity wrangling. Yes, I did rehearse that. Okay, Andrea Newhoff is a certified OUX strategist and a senior product designer at Duo. She's also an organizer for the Ann Arbor chapter of Ladies at UX. She's co-chair of Ignite UX Michigan. She grows vegetables in her backyard, and she just loves learning new things like bocce ball and woodworking and metalsmithing. And this year, a ton of that learning energy went to learning all the ins and outs of object-oriented UX. Kristen is a senior product designer at Detroit Labs. She has designed products for enterprise users at companies such as Duo Security, GE, and Google. Kristen prides herself on morphing complex technical environments into intuitive and human-centered experiences. Wonder why she loves OUX so much. She's also a UX educator and teaches designers at Amazon and Seattle's School of Visual Concepts. She teaches them skills in influencing and articulating design decisions and design thinking. And a little sneak peek here, Kristen and I are actually discussing a collaboration for later this year, maybe early next year, some sort of workshop on how to teach object-oriented UX to your colleagues. Okay, so before we jump into the discussion, I just have a few quick, very important announcements. Don't hit that skip button. All right, so first, congratulations to Lauren Stone from Cohort 2. She's going to be starting at Florence Healthcare, thanks to a job that I posted in the forum on behalf of my friend Havana Nguyen. So Havana's been in more than one OUX workshop, and she just knew that pulling an OUXer into the crazy complexity that she deals with at Florence would be so beneficial. So Lauren saw that job post, applied, knocked the socks off the folks at Florence, and she's going to be starting there in the next few weeks. So Lauren, we are all so happy for you and this awesome opportunity to spread the OUX love at an amazing organization just doing really wonderful things in the healthcare world. Hey, so if you're looking to hire an OUXer, this just occurred to me that I should probably invite you to email us at hello@rewiredux.com with your job post, and we'll put it on our strategist-only job boards. This is only if you're specifically looking for somebody to use their OUX skills at your organization. Please email us, hello@rewiredux.com. I'm surprised that I hadn't thought about inviting you to do that until just now. All right, okay, so two more quick announcements. Secondly, I have an almost free OUX training session next Thursday, where I'm going to be going over the 4 UX mistakes you probably don't know you're making, and of course, how OUX can help with you. So that's going to be August 12th. I'll provide you with 4 brand new UX heuristics that you can immediately put to use to make more elegant and intuitive UX systems. So if you're not yet familiar with shapeshifters and masked objects and broken objects and isolated objects, or just feel like you want a refresher on those and the corresponding heuristics, this is a great way to get up to speed. It's only $9, and all the proceeds go to helping me continue to fight the OUX fight. So thank you for that. All right. Finally, last announcement. Enrollment for Cohort 5 of the OUX certification is open. We are already halfway full, and if you want a spot, go, 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 go. The 10-week course, it starts on August 30th, and it requires about 10 to 15 hours a week of a commitment. So this is totally something you can do while working full-time. Most people that do the course are working full-time. Starts August 30th. Oh, yes, OUX.com/certification to learn more about that. All right, that's enough for me. Let's go talk to Andrea and Kristen. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it. Andrea, Kristen, welcome to the OUX podcast.
Thank you for having us.
We're so happy to be here. Thanks, Sophia.
Yes, this is going to be really fun. So, all right. So we are here to talk specifically about how you've been bringing Object-Oriented UX to Duo Security. So Andrea, you've been at Duo for a while, almost 3 years, which is forever in internet years. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of complexity that y'all work on at Duo? What is Duo Security all about, and what kind of problems do y'all tackle there?
Sure. So Duo Security is a two-factor, multi-factor authentication company. We allow businesses to protect their apps and help ensure their workers or their students, you know, actually make sure that the right people are signing in and that, you know, nobody's not doing that. For that reason, we have to deal with networks and applications. And as you can imagine, a business might have 20, 30 applications, hundreds probably, if they're larger. So we deal with sort of enterprise network level like complexity. You know, there's lots of objects, lots of things, lots of people. And, you know, our IT admin is one of our primary personas. So we have to make sure that they can get their work done easily.
Okay. So you mentioned schools. So like a college or something might be a customer. So I went to Georgia Tech. So Georgia Tech might use yes. Duo Security. That might be yes. Okay. And so if Georgia Tech says, hey, we're having some security issues, or we have like, what kind of security issues might they say, okay, now we need to use something like Duo Security? Like what might happen to somebody to motivate them to need Duo?
Usually that would be something like a data breach where a hacker stole somebody's credentials and they got access to an important data system. A lot of colleges and a lot of businesses nowadays are a little bit more proactive about that. They know what their highly sensitive or really confidential information is, and they put in two-factor like way in advance beyond just kind of an incident or two. It's sort of good business practice these days.
Right. What about hospitals?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you got to keep that medication, medical records. You have all of HIPAA compliance to deal with. We also now also serve federal organizations as well. So we are certified or FedRAMPed, as they call it, whatever that business is.
Okay, got it. So just to dig into the details on this a little bit more to make sure that I kind of understand what's going on with Duo. So are you kind of like, do you have sort of an out of the box solution, but then there's a whole lot of configuration, I'm guessing, that needs to happen for each of your customers, right?
Yeah. So we are an out of the box solution. You'd buy Duo, you could start setting it up within 5 minutes. You know, we've seen proof of concepts go up that very quickly. And then the thing that we're really known for is actually making security usable for the end user. Security that nobody wants to use or finds a pain, you know, they're going to find workarounds around it, right? So that's not actually accomplishing the purpose of the software. So that's one of the things we're most known for, is having a very usable, easy to understand product so that end users, you know, students or employees can just get in. It's a moment of their day. It's not a big deal. It just goes by so quickly. And then they're in, and, you know, the company or the school feels a lot safer knowing that they are double checking somebody's identity.
That's really interesting that's such a user experience concern, because if it is too hard, people will find the workarounds and basically cheat around it. And you've completely, you've defeated the purpose.
Well, and security is an arms race, right? Like every time a new development is made in being more secure, there are people who are figuring out how to get around it. And so it's a very interesting design problem. And it's a space we'd actually love to see more designers entering and dealing with, because there are a lot of security practices that don't often take into account everyday people and the weird behaviors that we have.
Yeah, we do have lots of weird behaviors. that's a whole rabbit hole to go down. So you have UX designers, you're both product designers. Do you have, like, I know at Salesforce, there's people that work on the product, and then there's people that they actually have UX designers that work on implementations. So do you have, just like, who does these implementations? That's not y'all. Y'all are working on the product.
We work on the product itself and building out the new features and stuff. We have a side arm called Duo Care that will help companies actually implement and roll out Duo. They are not designers, but they do a really great job. And we actually often talk to them sometimes about, you know, what's the best way to implement this feature or how to make it approachable.
Yeah, that seems like that would be really important, to be having conversations with those folks that are on the front lines doing that implementation work and configuration work. Do you consider them end users as well? Or not end users, but are they kind of a role within the people that are actually doing that configuration?
Not as much, because they get to have access to all of our engineers and our internal knowledge. They know a little bit more, but we do use them as a resource when we're doing larger design projects. You know, they're often involved as subject matter experts.
Okay. So I've got a much better idea. Hopefully all the listeners have a much better idea on what Duo Security is all about. So before we jump into all the nitty gritty of how you're using OUX at Duo, I'd kind of love to understand a little bit more about y'all's roles at Duo. So Andrea, as I said already, you're a veteran, you've been there for a few years now. How has your role sort of changed and evolved? Like, what did it start as, and how are you, and how did it kind of grow into what you're doing there now?
Sure. Well, usually when you start as a designer at Duo, you're assigned to a particular team and you work with them on whatever features or problems they're trying to solve. So you end up starting with a sort of a very narrow scope, very focused. And as you progress and learn more and become more senior, your sphere of influence grows. You know, you might start by helping them enact features, but then you might start working more closely with the product manager or the engineering manager to figure out what you should be working on, or what the roadmap is and where the problems are. And then as you grow in your career and become more senior, you then start to affect, you know, what larger initiatives are happening or where the business is driving. I'm somewhere in that transition time between affecting what the team does to looking towards larger initiatives. So I've stopped working directly with a team, but I'm now looking at doing a research project on like what we should build next for a certain particular area.
Oh, that's fun. Yes, it's a lot more strategy work. And also thinking about how the work is done. We'll get into OUX on that topic.
And we were purchased by Cisco. So now we are also looking at how we work together as a suite of products. And that's, you know, that's a lot of OUX there, is how do you bring these different products that are arranged around different objects together? And ensuring, you know, they all have the same definitions and are treated the same. Because there's definitely talk about combining, you know, Cisco products, or not combining, but integrating them that are, you know, based around totally different things.
And we'll definitely loop back to that, because that is something, that's actually a question that I've gotten quite a few times, is how you deal with mergers and acquisitions when you're trying to sort of audit how you would actually bring two products together, and like, is this object the same as this object? Does this now need to become one object? We need to get into that later. So Kristen, tell us about your Duo journey. And so you actually started during COVID. I'm sure that was interesting. So what did you come on kind of expecting to do? What did you end up doing, and how did it get you to where you are now?
Yeah. Hey, much like Andrea, I started working with a feature team. And I did want to mention that we have two kind of core personas that we focus on. So Andrea described like making the end user experience as simple as possible so that it's easy and approachable to use, like better security. We also have an IT administrator persona. And a lot of what I worked on was making sure that the process of setting up and configuring Duo was easy for the IT administrator. And as you can imagine, there's so much complexity in security, and that all gets translated into product sometimes. And so one of the things that we're also known for is just having a delightful and straightforward setup process. And so when I started at Duo, I was working on things related to the configuration, and over time got completely in the weeds with that and was very much drawn to the most technical configuration in our product. And that was rife with complexity and confusion, was known to be this sort of quagmire amongst people in Duo and outside of Duo. So I was like, all right, I've got to take my like design brain to that. So I worked on that a lot as well.
We'll get into the quagmire of, I mean, what I think is so interesting about what y'all are doing and how you're using OUX is just, you have so many abstract objects. And that is a challenge for a lot of folks. Taking that abstraction and sort of putting edges around it is very, very helpful, but to figure out where those edges go on these abstract, sometimes overlapping things is a huge challenge. So, Andrea, so you were a catalyst that actually brought me in for a workshop. Thank you for that. What motivated you to say, okay, there's this OUX thing out there that I've been toying around with. We need to bring this into Duo. So, sort of like, what problems did you hope it was going to solve?
Yeah. So I was starting on a project where the engineering team and the product manager and myself, we all knew what we like needed to do at the end of the thing, but we had no idea how we were going to get there. And in all my conversations with folks, I kept on being like, well, what are the pieces I'm working with? Like, I don't even know how to design this workflow or these screens if I don't even know what pieces I'm working with. And that's what tuned me on to like, reminded me, oh, object-oriented UX, that would really help us define, you know, what tools we have and how they're going to interact with each other, because no one was able to succinctly do that. And at the same time, I was talking with Kristen about some of her work, and she had just completed a large research phase, and they were having a hard time moving into design. Because sometimes when you complete all that research, it's like, well, where do you start? Especially with a very complex sort of problem. And so in talking with her and a few other coworkers, I saw that there was a kind of an interest there. And then I just hit up our director and was like, hey, do we have any budget for this? Can we do this? Can I use my training budget for this, if nothing else? And that's just, it snowballed from there.
Yeah. I mean, that's when you have a bunch of research and you need to kind of pull that research together. That's, I mean, if we think about the double diamond, I often say that like you can like look at the double diamond of research and design. You just look at it and you can see the weak spot right there in the middle of taking all of that research. And then what do? You just start sketching. You just start sketching some screens based on your research. It's really hard to do that. And I always felt like I was still doing a lot of guesswork or something would fall through the cracks, especially with something so complex where you have these business rules and things like, security business rules, where if you don't get it right, if you don't get those business rules right, or those user needs right, like you could be in big trouble. So working in you know, insurance and medical billing and those types of domains, I was just always so nervous. I was like, I'm going to let something slip through the cracks here. And you could do those. I'm curious to know, I'm just kind of telling my story around this, but I'm curious to know kind of what it looked like before in y'all's careers. But for me, it was annotated wireframes. So I would have sometimes all of the, I would have all the requirements. Maybe I had a BA that I was working with, maybe not. Maybe I was playing the BA, but I would have all these requirements either in a Word doc, like a PRD, a product requirements document, something like that. Or a spreadsheet, that was fun, or both. and all the requirements would be numbered. And then in the wireframe, we would annotate those and to kind of track like, okay, this part of the wireframe is what is fulfilling this requirement over there. Do y'all have any, like, how did you do that in the past before object-oriented UX? How are you sort of making sure that you fulfilled requirements?
Yeah, so I have really fond memories of sitting in a conference room with fellow designers amidst like a sea of post-it notes after we've like affinity diagrammed our research and things like that. And we often did something that I think was almost like a precursor to the sort of the translating the object map to the navigation diagram. We started to draw out different views And the types of research findings would all inform, like, how do we want like this all details view to translate into the individual detail view and so on. And so when I saw in your workshop the sort of navigation diagram and how the objects inform that, I was like, wait, that looks really familiar, but it's so much better and more comprehensive than what I would see my process as being, like this kind of hand wavy experience of taking what was on the top of my mind from the research findings and then translating it into an information architecture and interaction diagram.
Andrew, do you have anything to add to that?
I would say before OOUX, I like, Kristen, I like how you said that, like, you would take whatever was top of mind from the research, right? And it hand wavy to everybody else. It kind of just seemed like magic appeared. And the problem with that is that the other people you're working with, like the designers or the engineers, are also doing that, maybe not explicitly. And they have all these ideas as well. And so then it's like your idea versus theirs. And there's no necessarily like they both solve the same problem, but it's like, then you're arguing like A versus B. And that's kind of an annoying argument to have. So I'd say that there's a lot of churn if you don't do this, because in doing this, you start to see exactly how things are laid out. You agree on priorities ahead of time. So, to be honest, I'm used to like having to go back to the drawing board a couple of times, you know, iterating just to get that basic consensus about like what's really important, or, you know, making sure everybody's there.
Yeah. And how, I mean, just if you're working on an object map together, and I'm excited to get into collaboration and the successes and challenges that y'all have had with that. But when you're working together and you have business folks and maybe even a developer working on that object map together, you just kind of see, it's like this bird's eye view. You just sort of see all the pieces, Andrea, as you were saying, laid out, and all the pieces of the pieces, and then how they all relate to each other. And it's just kind of, everybody can kind of nod their head and see like, ah, yes, it's that comic of like everybody thinking of the different thing, that like, yes, everybody has a different thought bubble. It's bringing all those thought bubbles together to make sure we're all on the same page before you get to screens.
I really like doing jigsaw puzzles. So I always think of it as like the first step of like flipping all the jigsaw puzzle pieces so they're right side up, right? So that then you can start to sort between, you know, border pieces or colors or whatever you want to do. But like, you got to make sure you're working on the same puzzle and that everybody can see all the different pieces that need to go into it.
That's such a good metaphor. And I think that so much of UX design is trying to put the puzzle pieces together without flipping them over first.
Or even making sure you're doing the same puzzle, you know, like.
Oh my goodness. That's so true. If somebody might be on a completely different puzzle with pieces that just don't even fit in, or an idea of what those pieces are. Yes, that metaphor resonates for sure. Okay. So Kristen, let's talk a little bit about collaboration. So you, as you were sort of going through your first workshop, actually let's back up. Because you were in the Duo security, like the workshop that I was running, and you came into that workshop, like when did things sort of start to click for you? When did you kind of start seeing like, okay, this is something that I could potentially use on some projects in my work?
It was definitely when we started to talk about relationships. So the type of configuration design work that I do involves almost every part of our IT administrator's product, which is called the admin panel. And so as we started to talk about the relationships and how relationships informed what showed up on different pages, that super, super sparked a lot of inspiration in me, because a lot of what we're doing with this particular space is making sure that we expose like where the configuration choices actually affect things. So where a configuration choice affects a user or affects an application or the devices that can access the application. And the type of setup that we have right now is like very much like you set up a configuration and then it's like, well, I hope I hope that worked, because I have no idea how it affected anything. So OOUX was a very systematic way to make sure we were exposing the relationships and exposing them in the right way and not forgetting something. So that was one of the like first things that I went to my product manager, Alicia Fremley, and our architect, Aaron Campbell, and said, this is an amazing way that we can actually make this less complicated for ourselves as well as we start to design it.
So for the listeners, a good way to do that, just a hot tip, is to create sort of a matrix. So you have all of your objects across the x-axis and then the exact same objects down the y-axis, and you just look at the intersections and you kind of play relationship battleship and sort of describe the relationships. And some of them won't have any relationship. Some of it'll be a big X, but I mean, having at least a 5-minute conversation with your team, or even a 30-second conversation with your team to say, okay, no, there's no relationships here, but between these two objects, there's like 6 different types of relationships. So you'll have different concentrations in that matrix. I actually ran into this just yesterday. And when those relationships aren't there, in the OUX world, we call those isolated objects. An object that is not connected to the objects that it should be connected to, that it's connected to in the natural world, but in the software, those connections just don't exist, probably because there wasn't an intentional process on mapping those relationships. Yeah, Andrea.
I just want to add that Kristen, I really like that you point out the relationships, because I think that's the part where the engineers get really interested and really drawn in, because they're the ones who are making mm-hmm. the databases to store all this information. And so when you start having these conversations about like, well, does it have to have one to begin with? Does it, you know, can it have 0? That's when their gears start turning and the system starts coming alive to them. And they're so appreciative of that, because we've done half their work, not done half their work, but we've had an explicit conversation about them. And it's not them just getting a task and having to figure it out on their own and hoping everybody catches all the relationships. I found that when I did that with one team, like that was when I had them and they were like, yeah, I'm into this.
That's super hard. I mean, can you imagine as an engineer having to do that through reverse engineering a bunch of wireframes?
It's so frustrating.
I mean, the metadata and the attributes, like that might be a little bit more straightforward. Like I can see, okay, you know, there's a description there, there's a status there. Okay, maybe I need to go look somewhere to figure out what those values for status might be, and maybe what the conditional logic would be. Okay, there's like 6 different screens to show all the conditional logic, but the relationships, having to kind of pull that apart to figure out how you're going to design a database through reverse engineering a wireframe is not the most efficient way to do that. And then on top of that, sometimes wireframes will assume potential relationships where from a technical yes. perspective, you yeah. want the developer to be like, that is a huge lift to connect those things. And so as a designer, and y'all are both nodding, did that happen at all where the developer was saying, oh, wait, those really, that's going to be really difficult to actually connect those things?
Yes. Kristen, you go for it.
Oh, thanks, Andrea. So what was exciting, we can talk a little bit about like how the workshop came into being, but one really striking moment for me in the workshop was when our architect said like, oh, these relationships don't actually exist today in the product, but I can see that it's really important that they do, and it's gonna take some effort, but we definitely should make this. So it was not only like exposing that they didn't exist, and giving us clues into the feasibility, but we had brought this architect along with us to the extent where he was a champion for doing this, like not necessarily additional work, but foundational work to make it possible.
And I can see, I mean, from if I kind of put on my empathy hat, I can see from a engineer perspective, being in that initial conversation and being part of the discovery of realizing that those relationships don't exist, you're much more bought into doing that extra effort versus inheriting a wireframe, realizing that now these things are connected that are not connected in the database, and being like, hey guys, you obviously don't understand how this actually works. This is a huge effort for me. and you've just sort of willy-nilly put it in the wireframe. I mean, from an emotional standpoint, it's the same work, but being part of that initial conversation, being part of mapping those out and having that kind of initial discovery conversation feels like it would be totally different.
Yeah. And it was such a powerful way to harness all of our unique perspectives and expertise to not only like build a relationship and trust and buy-in, but also to make the overall solution better. Because I can sort of sit in my like pristine desk and design things by myself. And then we have to have these conversations later, but by sort of inviting them in, them being the engineers and the product managers and like our guests stars in our workshops, we're all making the process that much more efficient and the product that much better because we're exposing things early on.
100%. Yeah.
That in reflection, if you're ever designing like some data or something and somebody says, oh, we don't have that number. And you're like, wait, what? That's really critical. How could we not have that number? That's when you know you need to have an object conversation. Like I look back now and I remember having so many of those, and it's because I inferred different objects from the system than they did. And I didn't understand how things worked. And I can only imagine how different those conversations would have been if we had started with a map or we'd started defining the objects and the relationships between them.
Y'all were working on different puzzles.
Seriously.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So I have to tell that like on the relationships before we move on, I just have to tell the story of what happened to me just yesterday working in. So the OUX masterclass is hosted in Thinkific. So there's a bunch of different like learning portals that you can use, Teachable, Thinkific being the two biggest ones. So I ended up using Thinkific and it is a nightmare. I mean, it's actually pretty good from the end user perspective, but like Andrea's like, it's okay. Yeah, there's definitely some weirdness. But one thing that I was wanting to do is, so I have a couple different courses set up for different audiences. And I was trying to figure out who was enrolled in what course, like such a quintessential relationship in the user, myself, mental model. There's students and there's courses, and each course has students that are enrolled in it, right? A course has many students. Like that relationship is one of the most core relationships in my mental model being in this product. I could not figure out. I had to get on chat to figure out how I actually see which students I had. I could go to my, they call them users. I could go to users and I could see the whole list of everybody. But then when I went to my course there, that's what I did first. That was my intuition, was to go to the course and there would be my list of the students that are currently enrolled in that course, maybe all their statuses and maybe even like some analytics, like how far had each student gone? Like that's what I was expecting to see. No. So what I had to do actually is I had to go to that list of all users, you know, a completely different part of the application. I had to go to the list of all users. And then there's a tiny little button at the top for filter. I didn't even see. And then I go into filter and then I have to set a filter for like an advanced search basically and say, enrolled in is yes. And then I have to select the course. And then
it wasn't even like a checkbox, like an easy list of courses.
No, I mean, it was a drop down. So then I had to like select. So it was basically an advanced search where I had to do like a Boolean operation to like figure out.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh. And then this, and if they had mapped out before they had designed Thinkific, like that would have been one of the main relationships that they would have seen is courses and students have a relationship there. And we want to, of course, manifest that relationship
right
in the screens, right? We need to show that relationship. So I was just like, you know, if it wasn't so frustrating, it would have been funny. I can laugh about it in retrospect now, but yesterday I was not laughing about it at all.
And that's really interesting because that to me seems like a misdirection, right? Like you're thinking about who are the students in my courses, right? So you're anchored around courses, but then the UI directs you to a place that you maybe eventually you would get there, but like to like, it's centered around the wrong thing, right? Like if you're going to have that information in one space, it sounds like for you, at least it would be under courses, right? And maybe users is all individuals and you can't do advanced filtering. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, like it is interesting how like you usually want to connect things both ways, but sometimes the strength of the relationship is more centered, like what you're saying is more centered around one object. So like, I would much more expect to see under courses, a list of all my students, like under the course, actually the individual, I'm on like the course detail page, maybe it's a tab or something. And I see all the list of all the students versus I'm looking at a student detail and seeing the courses that they're enrolled in. I want that too. Like I should have both of it. It should map both directions, but probably the use case is stronger for seeing a list of my students on a course versus like going to Andrea Newhoff and seeing, okay, Andrea Newhoff is enrolled in this course or these two courses or zero courses because she's on a free preview or something like that. Also impossible to see who's on a free preview. There's, oh. You can sign up and get a free, there's a couple videos that are set as a free preview. I can't see who's a free preview to like contact those people. And maybe I want to like give them an additional thing or something like that. I can't.
Yeah. I mean, if they want you to succeed, they should be making it easy for you to turn free, you know, people into paying customers.
Or if for some sort of like security reason, they don't want to show me who's on a free preview. That should also be obvious that like, oh, like, but it, right now I'm like, I just haven't found it yet. Like it has to be somewhere, but I haven't figured it out yet.
that is the thing. I'm always like, okay, I know this has to exist, but where is it? I cannot find it.
And that's another thing about relationships. So if there is a technical reason or a business reason why maybe in the user's mental model, things are connected, but you can't do it, then that's another design challenge to communicate that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, oh, like for example, if your developer was saying, and in the case between those objects where your developer got on board and was like, yes, we're going to do this. It's going to be tough. Like, in the meantime, is there a way to like even put some really good UX writing in place to show the user not only that like this is why it's not connected, but it's going to be connected soon. Like we're working on this. Mm-hmm. There's things that we can do as kind of stopgaps. All right. So y'all have both, to pivot just a little bit, I want to talk about how you're bringing OUX to Duo and kind of getting people on board. So you've both had success in sort of making OUX accessible and approachable to not only non-OUXers, but non-UXers. So how have you done that? How did you actually start bringing people on board and getting people involved?
Yeah, so I was really interested in doing a workshop after attending your workshop to address this really complex configuration space. And I myself was a little intimidated because I had now learned all of this amazing information and had to translate it and sort of bring folks on board and through this process. And so what I did was essentially start by sitting down and rewriting the process in my own words and then breaking it down to as small a possible chunk as possible. So we started with a series of 1 day, 1 hour workshops. So we had 1 hour workshop on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, and Thursday. And each day was centered around a different step in the Orca process. And I think that really freed up my cross-functional partners to attend because it didn't take up all of their day. But then once we actually got into the workshop, it was very much targeted like, all right, we're going to talk about objects today. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I learned from Sophia. This is why this is important. Here's an example that I came up with from another place in Duo. This is how this will affect the rest of the week that we're having together. And so we started really small and sort of built up our skills together from there. And it ended up being really exciting because we had special guests popping in every day. And these were representatives from other parts of our product, other teams. So we weren't like always having like 15 people in the room, but I made sure to invite them in where they would be most informative and most effective. And so not only did we sort of learn together and do it in a slow and approachable way, but we also built momentum and excitement as we would complete a different step and then say like, okay, we get to do relationships tomorrow, we get to do attributes tomorrow. And then the last thing that I'll mention is just like trying to put whatever is on our cross-functional partners, being really thoughtful about that. So I would go home and do my own homework to sort of clean things up, be able to recap what we had done the day before. And then once our series of 1 hour workshops was over, I went and like created some visuals to represent what we went through, shared it out. So it was very much like as easy as possible to get involved in OUX.
So I'm really interested. So first, for those that are listening that don't know what the Orca process is, that's basically the process for doing object-oriented UX, and it stands for objects, relationships, calls to action, and attributes. And we kind of iterate through that a couple times. So when you started starting with objects, great place to start. You said you'd done your homework. So did you kind of come in with an idea? Like, here's what I think the objects are. Let's talk about this together. Am I missing anything? Or are you defined? Like, how did you actually run that object definition workshop?
Yeah, so I did a bit of object foraging and put a bunch of potential objects on our mural board, which is the tool that we used throughout the couple of days. And I invited our product manager, Alicia, and our architect, Aaron, to do the same. And so we all sort of got our feet wet, so to speak, by just looking out at the research and the code and our product strategy as a whole to sort of pick out these objects. And then we were able to come in and say, like, all right, here are a few jigsaw puzzle pieces that we can consider. Let's see what applies to this particular configuration space. And let's figure out what we want to focus on.
Were there any objects that were really surprising or that you realized, like, oh my goodness, we have a totally different idea on what these things are?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's call our configuration like a security rule. We had a really extensive debate as to whether a security rule was an object or not. And I was super lucky because Andrea had just learned about junction objects. So these are objects that are informed
by... Oh, no.
It was extremely relevant to our interests. So these were objects that were informed by other objects. And so as you can imagine, a security rule that is created by an attribute from the user, an attribute from an application, an attribute from a device. So you might want to say, like, I want to create this rule so that only...
Are you saying rule or role?
Oh, rule.
With a U?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure.
Oh yeah, no problem. So these security rules could say something like, we want only HR administrators to be able to access Workday. For some reason, theoretically everyone should access Workday, but as an example. So we had a long conversation about whether a security rule was an object in and of itself because you could take action on it, or if it was informed by it, like in and of itself, it does not have any attributes. It is sort of a collection of other objects. Mm-hmm. So that's what we landed on. But it was a really spirited debate.
And that's one of those abstract objects that really, like, once you get edges around it and you all agree on what this thing is, I mean, that could take, and maybe that's not just in 1 hour. I mean, that could take days. That could go lots of back and forth. You could actually even go forward with an object map thinking that this is an object. And then you realize, oh, maybe it's not an object, or maybe something that you thought was an attribute is an object. That object definition is sometimes a real challenge, especially when you get into those abstract ones. And I was talking to somebody on Twitter, I don't remember who it was, who was talking about finding objects in insurance, and they had an object called context. And I was like, ooh, tell me more. Like, what is the context object? And it makes total sense. So it's very similar to that, but it's basically like you have a policy, and a context might be, it's basically like a group of rules or like a location. So like what state you're in versus like maybe what industry you're in. And so that creates a bunch of basically a context that different policies could sit on, but you want it to be reusable. Right. Mm-hmm. So this policy for this business in this context is going to be something versus this policy for this business in the same context is going to be something else. And you get that junction object where you get policy and context, and then it probably comes together to something like a policy, probably different, like policy configuration for this guy and his industry maybe means something different than policy configuration for what it means for Duo. So it's also, you need to define the object in a way that's specific to your industry and your business, which is a whole other challenge.
So are you ready to immerse yourself in OUX through the learning experience of a lifetime? Enrollment is open for cohort 5 of the OUX certification program. Week 1 kicks off August 30th, and the course runs for 10 weeks, wrapping up well before the holidays. So here's just a few words that have been used to describe the program. Life-changing, mind-blowing, instrumental, brilliant, buffed up IA, the best way to do IA, game-changing, and this is one of my favorite ones, easily one of the best training investments you could make. So you can learn more at oaux.com/certification and read more real reviews of the course at oaux.com/testimonials. All right, back to the discussion.
Andrea, anything to add to that about just getting together to define the objects and figuring out what they are?
I think Kristen did this really smart by having like short, brief periods of time, because in addition to letting people focus in that hour and not being like, crap, I'm missing all these conversations and meetings and all that scheduling nightmare, but it allowed people to like sit on it overnight. Like even if they weren't explicitly thinking about it, their brain got to mull it over a little bit. They got used to it. They got a little break from learning so they could like get used to that. And then she could level them up again the next day. So taking it one step at a time, I think was a really nice thing for like, you know, an engineer who's like making really critical decisions on a daily basis. Like you're not putting too much extra burden on him. You're saying, hey, we're just going to take this, you know, one step at a time. So I thought that that was really smart. I did the same thing with another team that I was working on. Actually, the first OOUX project I did at Duo. And it was just partly because like they had all this other stuff to do and they were really appreciative that I was like, all right, we're just going to do this little bit today. However far we get, great. If we don't get that far, great. And we'll show up again the next day. And, you know, in this Zoom world or this video conferencing world where everybody's got more meetings, like it just made it so much easier.
Right. And I've noticed that. I mean, when I had to translate the workshops that I run for companies, I had to translate that from me going and flying somewhere, you know, basically the entire thing was done in a day or two. We had to squeeze it all in because, you know, hotels and flights and it's just logistically. But then once we moved to doing virtual, we could break it up more. And I've even had workshop customers that want to break it up week by week. So we'll do like OUX Fridays and we'll have like a 2.5 hour workshop on one Friday and then 2.5 hour workshop the next Friday and just kind of pick a day and sort of, yeah. And then you have like homework between and you can let it sink in and figure out what your questions are. So then we would start the workshop with Q&A and like, okay, what came up during the week? Did you go and try this? So being able that was definitely a perk of running the virtual workshops is being able to spread it out more. But if you're in a workplace, even if you are in person and everybody's in the office, you could also do that if everybody's already there. So Kristen, I'm really curious to hear more about these guest stars that were kind of coming in and out, because one thing that I've always been super adamant about is I actually put it in my contracts is to not have a lot of people coming in and out, because I feel like sometimes when people are coming in and they're coming in the middle and they're like, oh, you have to explain everything. And it's just kind of, in my experience, you sort of lose momentum. So I'm wondering how you made that really successful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I nominated our guest stars before our workshop and invited them to join the object definition session in particular. And so this was a way to take our sort of small group and sort of make it that much larger and have a much better informed conversation about what our objects should be. And so we invited them for this first session. And then I said, hey, if you'd like to join any of the other sessions, we would love to see and like sort of confirm with y'all as we go along if this resonates with your particular team and your scope. And I definitely know what you mean about having to sort of bring everyone back up to speed. And I think because we were breaking it up into such small chunks, it was really important to just have that like level set at the beginning of each hour anyway, just for the three of us. And so I found that the fact that we were like, all right, we talked about objects yesterday. This is what we came up with. Today, we're going to talk about relationships. That's what that means. We were able to loop in any of our special guests that wanted to pop in different parts as well. But I think because we were treating it almost like a design critique in a way, it was really helpful to be able to communicate and practice telling the story around what our objects, what our relationships, what our calls to action and attributes were, and see if it made sense to someone who hadn't been in the room with us for this entire week, to see what questions that they had and to see where we needed to sort of pressure test how we were actually bringing this into life.
So it turns out that actually rehashing it is sort of a feature and not a bug.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We got a lot of great sort of subtle iteration in that process.
So tell me a little bit more about the storytelling. That's something that that you mentioned before in a previous conversation about how kind of using storytelling and also other practices like latching onto jobs to be done. So what did that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you and I have talked about the OOUX process as being like design technical, something that is very like technical from the sort of definitions and aspects and pieces of it in the design scope. And so what was really important to me as we came out of this workshop was to make sure that that was immediately understandable and resonant with an audience that had never experienced the OOUX process before. And so what I wanted to do, I borrowed an analogy from the Think Company, and I used that when I described OOUX at the beginning of every presentation, which is this idea of like, we think in objects and not in actions. And so there's this beautiful diagram that this Think Company has created where there's like your dog, your car, your baby, and you. And you don't think about like, what are all the things that I have to wash today? Or what am I going to feed right now? You think about like, what does my child need? Or where do I need to get my car washed or something like that? Or what do I need right now? And so taking all of us like for a second at the very beginning out of the sort of four walls of Duo and just thinking about like who we are as humans and how objects are relevant to us in all contexts of our life. That was really helpful to sort of ground us in something that was very tangible. And then the storytelling aspect, you mentioned jobs to be done. So that is like something that comes up all the time when we're talking. And so it was my task to see how we could sort of map to that same framework. And so when I presented things like the objects and the relationships between the objects and how that informed different views, the way I described it like is essentially, what job does our IT administrator need to do? So let's say he wanted to understand this user was blocked from Workday. What like security rule blocked him? And I walked through like different screenshots of our product in our non-OOUX model. And there were like 10 screens that he had to jump to.
It was awful. It was like, oh no.
It was intense. And so the job that he needed to do is like just to understand what security rule blocked a person. And that's one of the core sort of use cases. And so just to be able to demonstrate, like, this is how we've set it up now, or let's look at sort of the relationship OOUX view where like the security rule is an object that appears on the user view. And so I could just go to the user page and see like the different security rules. That was very much like bringing it back down from this sort of framework or sort of nebulous space of theory into something that could actually make the product better. So it's very much like taking things that folks were already familiar with outside of work in their lives, and then also what they're familiar with in the product to make OOUX that much more compelling.
That's so interesting. So just two quick things, credit where credit's due. So the baby car, was it baby car and something else?
Things you have to wash and the things you dog. Have to feed.
Yeah, baby car and dog. So that actually is from Everil Yankee, wrote an article in 2011. And I'm sure Think kind of was inspired by that article. 2011, this was 2 years before I even started thinking this way.
Don't read that article.
it is linked on OOUX.com. I'll definitely link it in the show notes. It's called, I think she called it Object-Oriented UI. Or no, it was called objects over tasks or something like that, objects versus tasks. But yeah, she was thinking about that. She didn't use the term object-oriented UX, but she was thinking about the navigation and what makes more sense in the navigation. Do you want wash, feed, or, oh gosh, I forgot the other one, fuel at the top of your navigation and then all the objects underneath, or does it make more sense to have the objects in the navigation? And it just makes it's like, of course you put the objects across the top, which is often what we like, that's usually the first way that I think about top navigation is, okay, what are the main objects in the system? The top navigation should go to those list pages. So you can just see like, okay, here's the things that are here. They're just listed right across the top. That doesn't always work, but that's a good place to kind of to start. So yes, credit to Everil Yankee for that particular, I guess, mechanism to start thinking about it. So my question, follow-up question about jobs to be done. So you were thinking about the jobs to be done that the user would need, right? So that's really, so to kind of like drive your use cases. I've also thought about using jobs to be done for the object. So what is the job of this object? What is its purpose? Kind of like, what is the, and the original like coffee versus kale article on jobs to be done. Oh gosh, we'll have to link to that too. I think one of the first things I heard about jobs to be done is the idea of somebody driving to work and getting a fancy iced coffee or something on the way to work. And like, what is the job, not of the person, but what is the job of the coffee? Mm-hmm. For that particular user. And it's like, is it caffeine? Or, and then I did a bunch of research and realized the actual job of that coffee wasn't for like somebody who's like getting like a frappuccino or something. It's not the caffeine. It's the like something to do. It's the treat. It's the something to do on the way to work is the real job of the coffee that they found out in research. It's not for a pick me up. And that kind of changed how they marketed, and it changed how they thought about what like a frappuccino is for the user.
That reminds me of those object definition guides you have people write after they've gone through the discovery level. I wonder, have you thought about incorporating the jobs to be mm-hmm. done as a different way to frame like the why question?
Yeah. So actually, exactly. So under purpose, there is a little note there, and I haven't gone too far with this, but like that's if you're already using jobs to be done. When you're writing the purpose of each object, to think about it in that jobs to be done framework, like what is this thing's job in the system? Like, why is it here? What and is that different for different users? Is its job for this user X, but its job for this user Y? Which is a really kind of, I think jobs to be done can be used in both ways to kind of come up with those use cases, but also better understand the purpose of each object within the system. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we only have a few minutes left here. We're already kind of going a little bit over time, but y'all told me you didn't have a hard stop, so I'm going to keep stealing time from you. So I just want to get into a little bit more of the details about this. You ran this hour every day and kind of how that worked out. So we talked about objects. When you got into relationships, did you do it? Give me the details. Did you do a system model? Did you do that nested object matrix? What did that look like when you were bringing people in? And relationships can kind of be hard to map out and hard to visualize.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually did the two mechanisms that you taught us in the workshop. So we had the matrix, and then we also expanded that out to the like really big circle with like all the different lines in between. I don't know the technical term for that.
Entity relationship diagram system. I call it a system model because it's a model of the system, but developers might call it an ERD, an entity relationship diagram. Yeah. So you actually did the nested object matrix first and then did the system model.
Yeah. And I think that was super helpful just to sort of accommodate different ways that different brains think. So for me, the visual map is a lot clearer for me, but we had a really rich conversation around the sort of nested matrix as well. So it was helpful just as sort of a teaching tactic to try something really complicated in a number of different methods to see what sort of elicited the most out of each participant.
That's very validating to know, because sometimes they do feel a little bit redundant. And I even talk about it as like kind of the battle of the redundant exercises, because you're kind of doing the same thing. You're mapping relationships in two different visual ways. And I've kind of stuck to my guns on that one, that like, yes, they're both valuable. I usually do the system model first though. So that's interesting. But yeah, for different ways that the brain thinks, and it is such an important exercise, I think it's fine to do it twice in two different ways. You'll get different stuff. Andrea, anything to add to that about kind of just the mechanisms and like how you actually document and work through those relationships?
I like doing both. Just like Kristen said, like it's just two different conversations. Like everyone, like if you do one and then you go to the other, you start seeing other things. So it's just a way to like make sure you're covering your bases. Like sometimes I get tripped up by the language. And so switching between those two helps me get over that and get past it and just keep moving on.
Wonderful. Did y'all, out of curiosity, so a question that I get a lot is, are we mapping the existing system? Or are we mapping the ideal system? You're laughing. Okay. So like, was that a conversation? And did you actually document like, okay, the line between this currently exists, but like this line, we got to put in red or something because it doesn't exist and it's going to be a big lift from development. Did you kind of give any of those relationships extra metadata around that?
Yeah, we 100% did that. And I think that was where building excitement and like a sense of ownership was really exciting among the three of us, because we could point out like, these don't exist, but this is so crucial to sort of link these two objects. So we've got to put time into it. So we did definitely map towards what we wanted the ideal state to be, but made sure to call out like, what is separating us from where we are now to where we want to be.
And that gets me into the C of Orca. So what did that look like? And also, I guess the compound question is, did you also think about existing calls to action versus future state calls to action that you should have within the system?
We definitely did. Yeah, the calls to action step was really interesting because there is a lot of CRUD activities that you can do as part of like a security configuration tool. So it was helpful to be able to push past that into the other sort of actions that one might want to take on the different objects, and then sort of figure out what existed today and what we needed to exist in our ideal.
And CRUD is, what does CRUD stand for?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Create. I'll skip the U, update and delete.
Is it? Yes.
What's
yes.
the R? Do you know, Andrew?
The R. Well, read. R is read. R is read. But often I skip the R because read, I consider kind of one of, I mean, it we get into like visibility, of course, but I put that as like a, when we differentiate our strong versus our weak CTAs, read is all about consumption. And I kind of think about that more when we get into attributes of like which objects can different roles see and which pieces, because you might have one role that sees part of this object and another role that sees another part of the object. So I think more about the R when we get into to visibility of attributes versus action. I read is kind of very passive action. But yeah, create and update and delete, super, super important. Oh my gosh, there's so many other things I want to talk to y'all about, but let's just get into the A just for completion's sake. And then Andrea, I want to talk about mergers and acquisitions just to, you know, just tag that on the end of the conversation. All right, Kristen. So when you got to the A, what did you do? Did you actually build an object map or just, was it kind of a list? And was that the last session that you ran?
Yeah, that was the last session that we ran. And for the attributes section, we had a really extensive, actually we drew it on the different axes. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that was the calls to action. I take that back. So we were able to sort of pour through all of the attributes that existed in the product today for each of our objects, which was really helpful. And then we also sort of used inspiration from the different relationships to see sort of what was missing, what information would support the relationship. And that eventually informed the cards that would show up for each specific object in the different views. And I want to just mention the thing that I found most powerful about the exercise as a whole. We were focused on a specific part of our admin panel product. But because objects like users and devices and applications, like that applies all across the product, across many teams and sort of contexts, we were able to take sort of the momentum that came from this workshop and expose relationships and experiences that didn't exist. So I was focused on this sort of security role configuration space, but we were able to realize something like, I, as an IT admin, I can't see all of the users that have access to an application. That relationship doesn't exist. Or I can't see like what security roles affect like which users or sort of which groups of users. And so exposing those gaps between the relationships sort of catalyzed this next effort into sort of looking at our navigation as a whole, which I think is super exciting. And we can reuse a lot of the work that we did in this workshop to sort of build on that foundation and make OOUXify our entire product, which is super exciting.
And that's so good to hear, because that's another kind of concern that folks have is like, oh, if I'm going to do OOUX, I have to do it for the entire product. We have to like think about this totally ground up. And you were thinking about the part of the product, but then it helped inform changes that might happen in other parts of the product.
Exactly.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, Andrea. You'll just end with like a little chit chat on mergers and acquisitions. So I guess what I would say is, what advice if somebody is, so the position, so you started, when you started at Duo, that was right before Cisco bought Duo, right?
I started during the very first day after the transition. So I actually signed two different job contracts, one with Duo and one with Cisco. And my first day was like, the week before, they had all gotten their new IDs and their new emails. So it was like, I wasn't technically pre-Cisco, but I definitely have seen the long transition.
You just like came in right at the eye of the storm, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. That just tends to be my thing. I just jump in.
Yeah. So what advice, I guess, in retrospect, like if you were doing it again, with your glorious OUX tools, how would have it been different? Like what advice would you give to somebody that is in that position right now of a complex space that, you know, now is either there's merging with a different company and now there's like two sets of products that kind of do the same thing, but not quite the same thing.
Yeah. I first want to say that I think our acquisition was very positive. We had a very strong feeling that Cisco really respected a lot of the things that we did and the way that we did them, and they let us keep a lot of that stuff. And the second thing, just to be really honest here, is I don't see everything. I'm still working to some extent within Duo, so I don't know all of the plans or whatever's going on actually between the products. But what I think, you know, we do talk with some of the other products that are owned by Cisco. And the place that I want to start, because I actually have not done this work, so I'm going to just, I just want to be really clear about that, is I just want to actually introduce the model. I want to bring the workshops to the other companies so they can start thinking that way. Because it would be so much harder to say, hey, this is the way we should think about it, you know, and just bring it and start jumping in on trying to merge things. And instead, if we brought it to them, people can clean their system up. They can think about it. They can get used to the topic so that then when we come together, I'm not explaining OOUX or no one's explaining OOUX. It's a little bit more inferred and understood of like, what are the issues we have to conceptually get over before we even start thinking about things. And, you know, this is less about like merging products and more about integrations, right? With like, mm-hmm. you've had conversations around APIs, right? APIs are in some ways very object-based. And so a lot of times that's how products are integrating. And so you have to have a really clear understanding of like, what am I calling and what thing am I getting back? And what thing am I sending and why? Like, why are we sending this object and not this other thing, or this piece of information and not that other thing? Because ultimately, you know, we are there to help companies keep their data and their people secure. And so you have to be really clear about who or what we're securing and who and what we're tracking.
So if, I've seen this in my work, and I'm seeing it kind of at this larger scale of, and also to all the people that are getting certified or that are certified, is having one OOUXer within a company is great, but difficult. Like if you just have one person thinking this way and everybody else is thinking very procedurally, it's hard for that person to make change. If you have two people, or if you have six people, or if you have one team that's thinking this way, that can create a lot of change. Now, if you have two teams on two different parts of the product or two different products, it's exponential. And then when you get into companies, then it's just, you know, you can do even more when you have that kind of, oh my gosh, I'm going to say it, that synergy. then you can just exponentially do more and more and more. And when I was talking to Imogen Levy on the podcast about this at Moorfields, I mean, they are like OOUXing the heck out of Moorfields Eye Hospital, but they're having to get information from other NHS institutes that have not been thinking object-orientedly. And so they're creating really great systems for sharing data because they're thinking object-orientedly. So they're going to have great APIs to play nice. But then when they're trying to pull information from other organizations that haven't been thinking this way, the APIs are just a mess and they're actually pretty unusable. So and that's one of her goals, is to kind of get the larger NHS organizations on board with this so that they can all play together. And then you get this like really exponential change. So I think that that's actually really insightful to at first get, you know, get the other product team or the other business teams aware of this way of thinking and get them thinking this way so that then you can have more productive conversations. All right. So before we wrap up, this has been amazing. Thank you for all of your insights and stories. Anything else y'all want to share with the listeners about any kind of advice for getting started in OUX, for starting to teach and share OUX? Anything else you think that the listeners should know about?
I will throw in that it is an amazing and extensive process to go through OUX, and it can be really intimidating as a new OUXer to have all of this knowledge and then say like, all right, now I'm going to go and explain this to all of my coworkers. But I will say breaking things down into the smallest bites that you can muster and sort of getting your hands around your understanding of the process and then being able to translate that to your coworkers, individualizing your coworkers so that you're telling them just the right information, the right amount of information at the right time. That can make it all that much easier. And I think I and Andrea are both super jazzed about OUX, and that sort of enthusiasm is infectious. Yes. So really like lean into that as you're bringing OUX to your companies.
And I'll say, so like I said before, I'm the kind of person that just kind of jumps in, even if I'm not an expert, and just starts trying out the system. If you just try it out for an hour and you like, you haven't wasted that much time. It's not like you're like putting on a day workshop. Like I would not start off with that. I would start with like a small mm-hmm. group. Just try to get the object map. Just try to get the objects decided, you know, like just jump in and do that, because there you don't have to have too much advanced knowledge, right? Part of the whole ORCA process is iterating on what you did before and diving a little deeper, and things change, you know. My course project, I changed some of the objects a lot, like from like the first couple assignments to like midway through and again at the end. And that's good. Like, that means that I have had like insights and, you know, it's not just doing the same old predictable thing, because if that's what you're getting, then you're not questioning things enough. So like, just jump in and do a little bit, even if you just figure out the objects and the relationships, that might be enough to like, last you a long time, especially if you're like working in-house, like we do with like, you know, we're all assigned an engineering team. It's a lot easier to have conversations about like what an attribute should be and how it should function if you're just right next door to me or sitting next to me or whatnot, you know. But the relationships, getting that out there, I feel like it's just, you just jump in. Like, it's okay. It's just an hour. It's just, you know.
Exactly. And just figuring out, I mean, if you figure out what those objects are and get definitions, like write a glossary, so you're at least just speaking the same language with other people on the team. That's just a great way to get momentum. And I often call the objects your anchors of understanding. And they do kind of like, when things get complex and the winds of complexity get strong, you can kind of hold on to those things, you know, and they might change, right? But like, you know, if you have like, okay, you're like, yes, we have a policy and we have a policy configuration and we all understand the difference between those and we can all call them something, you can have these, you can build on those conversations. I often say to not to get too philosophical here at the end, but I love how the Japanese have these words for kind of complex ideas. And I feel like I love language and getting into get kind of how language affects understanding and communication and complexity. But words like Kaizen and Ikigai. So they also have a word, I'm drawing a blank on what the word is, but there's a word for like, owing your boss something, like feeling like you owe your boss something, but ikigai being the reason to get up in the morning, or kaizen being continuous improvement. Once you have this nice word for it, taking ikigai, for example, you can build on that. You can say like, hey, are our ikigai in alignment or something like that? While it turns like kind of something that feels like sand in your fingers. You know, the reason to get up in the morning. Okay, that's sort of ephemeral and I can't really grab a hold of it. To ikigai is like turns that sand into a nice brick that you can then build upon. And again, it comes back to like putting edges on things. So just figuring out what, especially if you're in an industry, I'm speaking to all the listeners here. I'm on my soapbox. Especially if you're in an industry like Andrea and Kristen's that is so abstract, that is even more of a reason to use OUX. That's not that OUX isn't going to work for us because we're in such an abstract business. You want to be able to put those edges on things to be able to build more intuitive products. So Andrea and Kristen are nodding. So thank you so much, ladies. Thank you so much for being here. This was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having us. It's been really fun.
Thanks. This was rad.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!